active trial in France and Norway. Now, we've heard that there's a bill on its way, and several suggestions were made as to how one can deal with that possible delay. One further suggestion is, and I expect you to submit, that this committee speaks with its counterpart in justice to see how, what the progress is with that piece of legislation and whether some measures can be applied to expedite it and bring it to Parliament sooner rather than later, because it has a very fundamental impact on the mandate of the IPID. So I think it is also important for the purposes of these bills to note that Article 4 of the UN Convention Against Torture also covers the attempt to commit torture, as well as those persons who are complicit or participate in the commission of torture. Those who torture are often assisted or encouraged by others, or may indeed be the tool in the hands of someone else. But this does not absolve them from or dilute their criminal responsibility, and we must see the obligation to prevent and prohibit torture within that light as well. There were some questions earlier about the definition of torture. The full definition is given in footnote 13 on page 3, and I will just highlight the salient characteristics of the definition. The first requirement is that there must be severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mentally. Secondly, that this suffering must be inflicted intentionally. And the definition lists certain purposes there. For instance, the obtaining of information or a confession or punishing him for an act he or a third person has committed, and so on. But it's important to note that the definition says for such purposes as. It does not limit it to that. It can be for other purposes as well. These are merely guidelines in terms of interpreting the prohibition of torture. Thirdly, that such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity. And fourthly, it does not include pain or suffering arising only from inherent in or incidental to lawful actions. And I think the drafters of the definition were mindful to the realities of the situation, where one is talking about policing or prison situations, that in certain instances force may be necessary, but it must remain within the bounds of the law. And so a police official arresting a person and that person resists arrests, and the policeman stabilizes the situation, does not use excessive force, which would not be guilty of the crime of torture. But we have to be very careful about how we apply that at operational level. I think it is also important in, with regards to the definition to acknowledge that there are two broad schools of thought on what is torture. The Committee Against Torture applies the severity test, and that is dealt with in on page 4 of the written submission. And so the more severe the injuries and suffering are, and it could be mental or physical, then something would move from cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment to torture. The Special Rapporteur on Torture takes a slightly different opinion, and he says that it is when a person is under the control of a state official. So, for instance, when a person is in custody or after the person has been arrested, then any pressure that is applied on that individual must be assumed and investigated for the purposes of an allegation of torture. So I will now deal with the submission as it is deals with on page 5 on the independence of his investigative directorate bill. And paragraph 2 of the submission deals with the appointment of the executive director. And I think it is important that we must acknowledge that the executive director has very important role in terms of shaping the policy and practice of the directorate, and that at all times independence and impartiality must be maintained. So on paragraph 3 of the submission on page 6, it's noted that clause 6 paragraph paragraph 6 of it, that the executive director must at any time when requested to do so by the minister or parliament report on activities of the directorate to the minister or parliament. While little fault can be found with the requirement to report regularly to parliament, questions can be raised about the same requirement in respect of the minister. By way of comparison, for the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services, no such requirement exists. Section 90 of the Correctional Services Act requires that the inspecting judge must submit an annual report to the President and to the Minister, and that the latter must table the annual report in Parliament. Furthermore, the inspecting judge must submit a report in respect of each investigation undertaken to the Minister and to the relevant portfolio committees of Parliament. There is no requirement that the inspecting judge must report at any moment to the Minister when called upon. So while the intentions of Clause 6.6 may be noble, there is a very real risk that they may make the Executive Director of the IPID vulnerable to excessive reporting and meddling in the substantive affairs of the Directorate. I will now deal with the duty to investigate and criminal prosecutions following investigations. Some comments were made earlier this morning, and I'll try to be brief around this. The important issue here is that Article 12 of the Convention sets the threshold for initiating an investigation. And that threshold is that there must be a reasonable ground to believe that an act of torture has been committed in any territory. So other instruments have also dealt with this. I'm not going to deal with that. So in paragraph 6 of the submission, Clause 25E requires that the IFAD must investigate any complaint of torture which is referred by a station commissioner, magistrate, judge, legal representative, or the complainant in the case where the complainant is unrepresented. This requirement would, for example, exclude complaints lodged by the relatives of a victim of the crime of torture or by a police official who is not a station commissioner. While the clause does not limit the substance of the complaint, it limits the avenues to initiate an investigation. Moreover, Article 12 of UNCAT does not require a complaint to be lodged, but merely the existence of reasonable grounds to believe that an act of torture has been committed. The requirement for the lodging of a complaint set out in Clause 25.1 of the Bill therefore appears to prevent compliance with Article 12 of the Convention. In view of this, it is submitted that Clause 25.1e be amended to read as follows. The Directorate must investigate, and then paragraph E, any matter where there is reasonable ground to believe that an act of torture or other ill treatment has been committed. Paragraph 10 of the submission, the UN Special Rapporteur has in his most recent report identified impunity as one of the main reasons for the persistent perpetration of torture and other ill treatment across the world. Paragraph 11 of the submission, in this regard, Clause 6.4 is of importance as it mandates the Executive Director that he or she may refer matters to the National Prosecuting Authority for criminal prosecution. It should be noted that the responsibilities of the Executive Director listed under Clause 6 may not be delegated as per Clause 10.3 of the Bill. The implication is clear. It is only the Executive Director that may refer a case for criminal prosecution to the NPA. This provision has the potential to severely limit in a number of ways the extent to which perpetrators of torture may be held accountable. Firstly, it may create a bottleneck in the processing of cases and thus delay a sense of justice and redress on the part of victims. Secondly, discretion centralized at the most senior level of the IPID creates the risk that the executive director will become the gatekeeper of which cases are prosecuted and which are not. This degree of discretion centered in one person without any requirement in law to consult with or seek approval from other stakeholders is at best an extremely risky situation and may be severely detrimental to the independence and impartiality of the IPID. Thirdly, the discretion afforded to the executive director creates a double hurdle for cases to reach active prosecution. But perhaps more importantly, it usurps at least some of the authority of the Director of Public Prosecutions. Where it concerns allegations of torture, the decision to prosecute should rest with the DPP in an unfettered manner that is not preempted by another official. The Convention Against Torture in Article 7.1 also sets the requirement that cases where torture is alleged must be submitted to the competent authorities for the purpose of prosecution. If it is then the duty of the IPID to investigate allegations of torture against the police as required by Articles 12 and 13 of the Convention, then it must be compelled to submit its findings to the NPA for prosecution as required by Article 7.1 of the Convention. The submission then deals with transparency. In paragraph 14, reference is made to the concluding remarks on South Africa's initial report in 2006 to the Committee Against Torture. The committee essentially required more information about what is happening in respect of torture, allegations, investigations, and so forth. At paragraph 15, clause 8D requires the National Office of the IPID to gather, keep, and analyze information in relation to its investigations. The particular wording of clause 8D creates a real risk that the information collected will only provide a partial picture of the situation when compared to the requirements set by the Committee Against Torture as noted above. It is therefore submitted that clause 8D be amended to read, the functions of the National Office are to, at paragraph D, gather, keep and analyze information in relation to, at minimum, complaints lodged, investigations initiated, investigations conducted, investigations completed, disciplinary actions against police officials, prosecutions, convictions, sentences imposed, recommendations made, and actions taken by SAPS, and support and redress rendered to victims and their families. At paragraph 18, clause 9 deals with reporting on cases to the Secretariat, and whilst this is important, there's a real risk that broader and systemic issues may be overlooked. While the IPID has a critical mandate, namely to investigate, sight should not be lost of the duty to prevent human rights violations and particular torture and treatment. And Article 2.1 of the Convention is clear on that. In the case of the IPID, the duty to prevent should be read together with Article 11 of the UNCAT, which requires that certain policy procedures, rules, practices must be kept under systematic review. So based on its investigations, the IPID will be in a well-informed position to make recommendations on the systemic causes of torture and other ill treatment perpetrated by police officials and recommend preventive measures to be taken by SAPS. It's therefore submitted that clause 8 be amended to read that the functions of the National Office are to conduct research into the systemic causes of human rights violations, including the crime of torture perpetrated by police officials, and make recommendations to the Secretariat and the Minister regarding the prevention of such violations. The level of transparency should also be assessed in respect of investigations undertaken by the IPID. And a decision from the European Court requires that there should be continuous public scrutiny of the investigations. At paragraph 22, the monitoring mechanism proposed in clause 9 is a step in the right direction, but it is limited to the extent that it requires the IPID to report to the Secretariat on the finalization of cases and could be interpreted to mean to only report on finalized cases. Clause 9.3 further requires the IPID and the Secretariat to meet at least four times per year. Moreover, the composition of the Secretariat does not provide for direct public scrutiny, but refers to a civil society reference group in Clause 5.2a Roman 5, and a civilian secretariat of the civilian secretariat. But the duties of this reference group are not set out specifically and is only broadly linked to the functions set out in Clause 5.1 of the same bill. The proposed mechanism thus falls somewhat short of the requirement of sustained public scrutiny. At a practical level, the requirement means that independent persons should have direct and unfettered insight into investigations being conducted by the IPID all the reasons why certain cases are not being investigated. At paragraph 24, in view of the above, it is submitted that the requirement of sustained public scrutiny of investigations can be met by the creation of a standing subcommittee of the consultative forum with the explicit purpose to oversee and monitor investigations. It is furthermore proposed that the subcommittee consists of the executive director and no less than 5 persons who are not employees of IPED or other state institutions, with the exception of employees of national human rights institutions. The next part of the submission deals with forensic capacity. There's a lengthy quote from the special rapporteur on torture that deals with the valuable input that can be made by forensic medicine, and that speaks for itself. So in view of the above, it is submitted that clause 7.2 be amended to include a forensic capacity within the National Office. Note should also be taken of the Istanbul Protocol as highlighted by APT in its submission this morning. The submission then deals with the civilian secretariat. The functions of the secretariat are dealt with from paragraph 29, where clause 5.1 sets out the functions of the secretariat, and it requires the monitoring and evaluation of the police's compliance with the Domestic Violence Act. The reasons for the specific mention of this legislation are well-founded and historical. However, the police deals with a range of vulnerable individuals such as women, children, undocumented foreigners, mentally ill and physically disabled people. It is also the case that the police have to frequently deal with people who are under the influence and or addicted to alcohol and drugs. These individuals are particularly vulnerable to torture and ill treatment. It is particularly when such individuals are detained by the police or police cells that they are vulnerable to ill treatment at the hands of police officials and or fellow detainees. So, in view of the above, it is submitted that clause 5.1d be amended to read to monitor and evaluate compliance with the Domestic Violence Act and the treatment and conditions of detention of vulnerable persons, such as but not restricted to women, children, undocumented foreigners, mentally ill and physically disabled persons, and persons addicted to and or under the influence of drugs and or alcohol. Clause 5.2b3 requires the Secretariat to review police practices and develop best practice models. The clause hints in the direction of Article 11 of the Convention, which reads, each state party shall keep under systematic review interrogation rules, instructions, methods, and practices, as well as arrangements for the custody and treatment of persons subjected to any form of arrest, detention, or imprisonment in any territory. It is submitted that the clause then be amended to read that the Secretariat must, for the purposes of subsection 1, establish competencies and capabilities in its operation in order to keep under systematic review policies, interrogation rules, instructions, methods and practices, as well as arrangements for the custody and treatment of persons subject to any form of arrest or detention by the South African police with a view to preventing any case of torture and ill treatment. The next part deals with a visiting mechanism. It is by now generally accepted by experts in the field, the Committee Against Torture and so on, that proactive visits with a view to prevent torture and ill treatment is the most effective means to achieve this. I'm not going to go through all the quotes there, but at paragraph 34, it's important to note that the state's obligations extend beyond that of its own officials, and the state has a duty towards non-state actors, in this case to all detainees. In the detention environment, this duty of the state is of particular importance in the relationship between officials and detainees, especially with those detainees who victimize other detainees. The committee has also been clear on this issue, and it has stated that where state authorities or other actors acting in in official capacity or under color of law know or have reasonable grounds to believe that acts of torture or ill treatment are being committed by non-state officials or private actors, and they fail to exercise due diligence to prevent, investigate, prosecute, and punish such non-state officials or private actors consistently with the Convention, the state bears responsibility and its officials should be considered as authors, complicit or otherwise responsible under the Convention for consenting to or acquiescing in such impermissible acts. At paragraph 36, the Human Rights Committee has recognized also the value of independent monitoring of places of detention in General Comment 21. In the same paragraph, the UN Body of Principles for the Protection of All Persons Under Any Form of Detention or Imprisonment has also recognized this. And thus, at the bottom of paragraph 36, clearly the intention following from General Comment 21, as well as the body of principles, is that states must be proactive and establish such mechanisms domestically. This duty emanating from the ICCPR and the body of principles is important, as states that have not even signed or ratified the optional protocol to the Convention Against Torture also have a duty to establish monitoring mechanisms for places of detention. There is at present no independent body of persons in South Africa that visit police cells with the purpose to inspect and report on treatment and conditions of detention. in South Africa, the value of independent visitors was already realized in the late 1990s in respect of prisons, and the creation of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services was a direct result of this. The inspectorate has independent visitors who visit the 237 prisons throughout the country on a regular basis to inspect conditions of detention and the treatment of prisoners, including the recording of complaints by prisoners with a view to resolve such complaints. By using community members, the inspectorate has established a mechanism that is unique internationally and recognized for its affordability. The 2008-09 budget of the inspectorate was just more than 15 million rand, or an estimated 0.13% of the budget of the Department of Correctional Services. There's little doubt that the inspectorate has over the years made a significant contribution to the improvement of prisoners' rights in South Africa. South Africa signed the optional protocol in 2006, but has not yet ratified it. I'm not going to go through that long description of the mechanisms of OPCAT, but I turn to paragraph 39. In view of the above, it is submitted that the bill be amended to provide for a visiting mechanism in respect of police stations and other police holding facilities. Clause 8, paragraph 8b, already provides the Secretariat with the power to visit and enter any building or premises of the police service. It is admitted that this power be extended to provide for a fully fledged independent visiting mechanism as envisaged under OPCAT. It is furthermore submitted that the powers of the visiting mechanism be delegated to the provincial secretariats and that the necessary amendments be made under Chapter 4 of the Bill. It is envisaged that when South Africa does ratify OPCAT, that this structure can then be designated as a national preventive mechanism in respect of police custody. By way of conclusion, due to time constraints, there are certain pieces of international law that the submission is not dealt with, such as the UN principles on the effective prevention and investigation of extra-legal arbitrary and summary executions, as well as the International Convention for the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearances and the UN Declaration on the Protection of All Persons from Enforced Disappearances. I would like to thank the committee for this opportunity, and we are available should there be any need for our support further on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll immediately take the next presentation by Mr. Emmanuel Martinsen.
Thanks, Jefferson. Perhaps let me start by saying that on my way here, I had a serious debate on whether it would be necessary for me to go through issues of legality that I picked up as I was reading the bill. But then I thought, let me do it so that we don't burden the process by allowing issues that we might have picked up in the process that could have been rectified at a very early stage.
Can I also interrupt you, as I've interrupted others? I'm sorry. It will be submission number one.
When one was going through the bill on civilian oversight, there are a few issues of legality that one picked up.
Chairperson, I apologize for interrupting, but is it possible that the presenter could just introduce himself and tell us where he's from, who he represents, or whether he's here on his own accord? But in terms of his submission here, there's actually nothing that tells us who he is or et cetera. So I think that would be helpful for us, just to first get that clarification. Thanks, Chair.
And I think that addressed Mr. Lichter's question. I'm saying it is also covering Mr. Lichter's question on the identification of the member, where he comes from. He will always ask questions.
My name is Emmanuel Matisse, an unemployed young man from Limpopo, in my private capacity. Can I proceed? When one was going through the bill, there are clauses that when I read through, I see them to be inconsistent with the Constitution. Clause 23 and Clause 24, with regard to intervention of the National Secretariat in the Provincial Secretariat. But when I look at Section 125 of the Constitution, it says that the executive authority of the province vests with the Premier. Now, if you have a national department, whether by virtue of its own accord or on the directive of the minister going to intervene in the affairs of a provincial department. When I look at that, I thought that might not be consistent with what the Constitution provides for, particularly as it relates to Section 125 of the Constitution of the Republic. Linked to that and also linked to Section 12 of the Public Service Act, Clause 13 and Clause 17, that speaks to appointment and removal of office, removal from office of the provincial secretary, of the provincial secretary. Section 5 of the Public Service Act says that the appointment of heads of departments and heads of components in a provincial department vests with the Premier. And if a national department would then be able to go into a province, Or if the MEC would have to appoint a head of a provincial department in consultation with the minister. And if that removal has to be done in consultation with the minister, I think it might be in consultation of Section 12 of the Public Service Act, which says that appointment of heads of departments and heads of components and units in a provincial government is the responsibility of the Premier. Again, the same might apply, one might argue, with regards to appointment of the National Secretary. It is my understanding that the concern that the appointment of heads of departments at a national level, according to the Public Service Act, I think Section 3 and Section 12, is the responsibility of the President. Even though the President may delegate such responsibilities. But for this act to assume that, I thought perhaps that might equally be inconsistent with the provisions of the Public Service Act. I've also picked up the issue with regards to Section 7, Subsection 2, C and D, as well as Section 7, Subsection 4. About the responsibilities of the provincial secretary, which when I read between the lines they seem to be contradicting with the provisions of the Public Service Regulation, particularly Part 3 of the Public Service Regulation. And like I said, those are issues that obviously legal minds might have to look at and consider it indeed. What some of us are picking up might be true. There is an issue on section 16, subsection 1A of the bill, which speaks about the national secretary delegating responsibilities to the provincial secretary. I'm imagining a head of department at the national level delegating responsibilities to a head of a department or a unit at the provincial level, as to whether in terms of intergovernmental relations, such an arrangement is permissible. And perhaps it's one thing that our legal minds may also have to look at. I have also picked up that there is an issue with regards to what I see as confusing, particularly arising out of our current arrangement in various provinces. That we have provinces where civilian oversight over the police has been clustered with other departments like roads and transport, and we have other provinces where it is a standalone department. This bill, therefore, speaks of two persons, one being the head of the provincial secretariat and the other one being the provincial head of department responsible for safety and security. The head of a provincial secretariat is not given accounting responsibilities as provided by the Public Service Act. And I thought perhaps those are issues that we may equally need to look at to say, how do we make this distinction between a provincial head of department and a provincial head of secretariat? Also because when you look at structures that are created here, there is a provision for the National Secretary to meet with provincial heads of departments, and there is also a forum created called the SMS Forum for Secretariat. And the SMS Forum for Secretariat includes the head of the provincial secretariat, but does not include the provincial head for safety and security. And those are issues that perhaps, as we finalize the bill, we may equally need to look at. There is an issue that relates to reporting lines across the CSS provided for in section 19, which says that the provincial secretary would, amongst others, report to the national secretary. Like I said, these are legal issues that perhaps legal minds may have to look at. And so how do you get reporting across the two spheres? Is it a function that needs to be done between the heads of departments? Is it a function that can be executed through the SMS forum, through bilateral meetings, through MINMEC? Is it a political or administrative function? Because as it is now, on a quarterly basis, the head of provincial secretariat, through the head of department, is expected, amongst others, to report the national secretary, if I'm reading the bill correctly. The bill does not provide, even though municipal police is established in terms of the SAPS Act, the bill does not provide for civilian oversight over the work of municipal police. And for us, that is an area that we may quite need to look at to say, is there a need to provide oversight, civilian oversight, over the work of municipal police, or is that the place they are without anybody that is providing civilian oversight over the work that is being done by municipal police? I have picked up an issue of excusing from appointment as a national secretary. The bill provides that a member of the SAPS or a former member of the SAPS may not be appointed as a secretary. And I'm imagining here one day when I'm the Minister of Police and I'm appointing a national secretary. And by virtue of the work that the secretary does, I then decide that I want to appoint a person who has had expertise and inside information into the work of the FHS. Now, this person happens to be Louvo, who has retired from the FHS, and I've identified him for appointment. The Act would therefore make it impossible for me to appoint that person. Now I'm saying perhaps we may need to revisit that to say, why would we need to exclude former members of the SHS from appointment here? And that scenario might be a situation where Emmanuel is a member of the SHS. He resigned from the SHS to be appointed as a director in the National Secretariat. This bill as it stands, it tempers with my career path in the event that in the course of my growth, I may want to grow to become a National Secretary. Because by virtue of me being a former member of the SHS, whereas I'm not, there is nothing that stops me from being appointed in any position within the Secretariat other than as a secretary. Should I reach a stage where I aspire to become the National Secretary, this bill, if passed into an act, will prohibit me from being appointed as a secretary because I am a former member of the South African Police. Equally related to that is the issue of limits in the limits on the number of times that a contract of a national secretary can be renewed. The bill says it can only be renewed for one term of 5 years. I've even checked with the SHS Act. The SHS Act provides that a national commissioner's term can be renewed until he retires or until we decide not to renew. But with the national secretariat, for reasons that I could not understand, it says you can only have your contract renewed for one term. Whether there might be intentions out of your expertise and the service that you have been provided, that you have been providing to extend your term beyond one, the Act will not allow that, and perhaps it's an issue that we need to reflect on to say, can't we leave that to the minister to determine whether he wants to renew my contract or not for more than one term? Because as it stands now, should that opportunity arise, it will require the minister to come to this house first for this Act to be amended so that someone's contract can be renewed for more than one. There is an issue which is here in the bill, in line with the provisions of Section 2063 of the Constitution, about promoting good community police relations. When you look at this in contrast with the SHS Act, Chapter 7, that speaks about community police, one may conclude that the two are related. However, when you look at the sections of the SHS Act that are said to be subject to amendment arising out of this bill, the constitutional community police forum remains in the SHS Act and therefore remains a responsibility of the police, whereas on the other hand, the Secretariat, both at the national and provincial level, is expected to promote good community police relations. Now, my submission would be that it would only be perhaps correct to take that whole chapter 7 of the SHS Act and migrate it into the civilian oversight bill so that community police force can continue to execute the role that they're executing. Perhaps those roles might be defined, but it would be in line with the provisions both of the Constitution and of this Act to have the Secretariat taking responsibility of community police. When we engage both the Secretariat and the SHS, at least historically, one of the arguments that was always there was that the community policing forums are an unfunded mandate. There was always that gray area between the police and the SHS as to who takes responsibility over the work and functions of community police forums. And perhaps my submission that would be that maybe we may need to migrate Chapter 7 of the SHS Act into the Civilian Oversight Bill so that the responsibilities to establish and sustain community police forums become the responsibility of the Secretary. There is an issue in the bill which speaks to community safety forums. I am a former employee of the Secretariat of the Provincial Level. When you go into communities, our communities do not always understand the distinction between the police, the criminal justice system, and corrections. They would go to the MEC to complain about a person who was given bail, even though the police had arrested that person. They'll go to the MEC for sentencing to complain about a person who was arrested, sentenced, but was released on parole. Now, when you look at the SACS Act, it makes provision for community participation through CPS. Your Magistrates Act makes provision for community participation through lay assessors. And your Correctional Services makes provision for community participation through a parole board. Perhaps the debate that the committee may want to engage in together with its sister committees to say, is it not possible to rationalize community participation across the criminal justice cluster so that your representatives of communities across the cluster are not isolated from each other in terms of the work that they do? When people go into a CPF, the CPF should be able to explain what happened from the time a person was arrested, perhaps to the judicial process, until maybe that person got parole. And without necessarily speaking as a representative of the ruling party, it is contained in the document of the ruling party that community safety forums, amongst others, are supposed to provide oversight over the broader criminal justice system. And I thought perhaps that would find expression in this bill or in any other bill that you may want to consider for this table. I've also picked up that there are very good functions which were given to Secretariat, both at the provincial and national level, in terms of the white paper on safety and security, which expired in 2004, which functions have not been included in this bill, and the remaining functions that are just hanging with nobody to execute them, if I have to say so. One of the challenges facing the SACS currently is its ability to police social fabric crime. And because of that, the white paper on safety and security make it the responsibility of Provincial Secretariat and the Minister Secretariat to take responsibility for social crime prevention. The same can be said in terms of some of the issues contained in the National Crime Prevention Strategy. There are elements in the National Crime Prevention Strategy that the SACS may not be able to take responsibility for. Issues like public education, issues like mobilizing other sectors of government to make sure that we deal with crime from an environmental design point of view, and a whole range of other issues in the National Crime Prevention Strategy and the white paper, as I've said. And it is my submission, therefore, that the part of further crime prevention, which is there in the white paper on safety and security, may need to be included as part of the function that secretaries at the provincial level are supposed to take care of.
I will definitely give you 2 minutes to...
I'm doing the last one.
Yes.
Lastly, Chair, it might be a rhetorical question, but the question that I thought perhaps the committee may also need to look at to also assist us as members of the public to create distinction between state office. When you go to the public service, as understood that deals with national departments, and components of department, and when you go into this bill, reference is made to the Department of Police. And some of us are asking, what is the Department of Police? You have the SACS with its accounting officer as the general. Now you have the secretariat, and this bill then says you have the Department of Police. And perhaps we need to clear this confusion that some of us have to say, what is this Department of Police? And where it is located, because we see two distinct departments in the form of the SAPS and the Secretariat together with the ICD. But the bill speaks of the National Department of Police. And the Public Service Act also makes reference to the Department of Police with the General and its accounting office. So perhaps that is something that we say as we conclude, this deal may be related to this or unrelated. Can we define this Department of Police? Which one is it out of all these components that are under the Minister of Police? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. We really appreciate your input. The fact that you went through this bill as an individual and made the submission and came to Parliament to make your oral submission. We might agree or disagree with you, but we appreciate it very much. And I think some of the issues that you've raised, there are those that we think we might need to recheck as to whether, you know, yeah. I will now allow members to ask questions, clarity-seeking questions to the two presenters. Honorable Chafer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just quickly to the first presenter. The whole point of the ICD legislation is to try and narrow down their mandate and focus on investigation. How then does your proposal to ensure that they investigate systemic problems, how's that going to, how can they conduct a search into that kind of violation of human rights is what your proposal is? I mean, surely that would be more a job for another agency, perhaps the Secretariat, but surely that's not for the ICD to conduct a search into that kind of thing.
You've raised the issues. The CFPRI, you've raised issues regarding the executive director. That it would seem like he's the one who ultimately must deal with all these recommendations and issues. And the legislation, in fact, the bill also referred to him having rights to delegate some of those powers. In fact, we're talking about powers. Do you think that that is not enough?
To the first presenter, he says independent bodies to have access to IPID information. I would just like you to explain what type of these independent bodies that must have access and how is it going to be controlled? You deal with a lot of things, sometimes sensitive information. Of course, the question you say there are no independent bodies. That is, of course, that's not related to the issue I'm asking. No independent bodies that are visiting police cells. Don't you think Parliament portfolio committee is independent enough? When it visits police stations. You see, also you said that you recommend that independent bodies must visit police stations. Also, if you can, because you see, these are sensitive state security institutions. So if you want to allow people to visit them, it's better if you understand what type of those bodies, because in state security institutions, you don't just allow anybody. So there must be some checks and balances. That's why I would like explanations about this. You use it twice, this issue of independent bodies having access to information, then now they must use it police stations and so on.
But just maybe related, I'm noting you, related to that, you actually also are comparing this IPID and the prison inspectorate judge. And I'm not very sure whether their focus is the same. Because I think the prison inspectorate judge is not focusing on prison warders, for instance, or officials, focusing on prisoners, if I may put it that way, whatever, but about them. And these are focusing on the brutality of police. The other one is a judge, independent, of course, elected, I think, by the president, if I'm not mistaken. And the other one, surely, is a civilian, if I may put it that way. I mean, the comparison, is it a fair comparison? And just want to check on this one, because I think, for me, the comparison is not that on, unless I don't understand the work of the prison. They visit prisons to check on the conditions under which prisoners are kept, and that is their main focus, I want to believe. They have people who go there every day to check on that on behalf of the judge. I'm just citing an example, and I don't think it's the same thing with the investigating, whatever. And those issues of brutality have been mentioned in the bill you were in. So I'm just checking on this one, okay?
Thank you, Chair. My question relates to two issues. The one is similar to the question that I've asked about as well before. Is your reference to torture and the responsibility of IPED is extremely broad. You also talk about redress and rehabilitation, etc. Now, given the fact that we know legislation are coming, do you really believe that this is the body where it should be, especially since the capacity and the makeup of the department currently does not make provision for that, and we are basically in the anticipation also of what would be in the justice legislation? Might very well be that they say, in terms of police, that it becomes a responsibility, but I mean, there's no clarity on that issue yet. I would argue that it's not their duty. Then, if I can also just get your comment on that, you know, also in terms of how do we deal with the fact that currently there is legislation coming. Then, a chairperson, and last question, also to the first presenter, is on page 9 of his input, point 16. While I don't think there's any harm in broadening the functions of the National Office in terms of the type of information that they need to keep, I would again argue that the support and redress does not belong there. Last thing, Chairperson, in terms of the referring issues of that must go to the public prosecutor, the National Director of Public Prosecutor through the Executive Director of the of IPED. I might not be understanding the issue, but in my mind this is an administrative issue. It's not a question of the Executive Director having the leeway to decide whether it should go or shouldn't go, but it's just that you want one central point from where it goes to the where you go to the National Director of Public Prosecutors. What, in fact, the recommendation of the investigator in that specific case would be, would determine whether the Executive Director sends it through or whether there is no need to send it through because the investigator have found that there's no basis for a criminal charge. So can you just maybe just give us, enlighten us on those issues?
Thank you, Chair. My clarity question is directed to Mr. Marchese. You said a lot on CPS. You are suggesting that they should migrate from the SFPS to Secretariat. Why are you saying that? Can you detail that? Can you give me the present conditions of the CPS you're talking about, how they can be strengthened? Thank you.
CSPRI. You, on your very first paragraph, you are on the use of independence and impartiality. What would be your suggestion? I really tried to follow this argument, but I could not ultimately understand as to what your suggestion is with regards to that. Referring to Mr. Matisse, he is actually saying that it will be wrong for the Secretariat to have her or his term renewed once. What would be his view regarding that? Do you think that it must be a permanent appointment or a renewable appointment, a contractual appointment? What is his view in regards to that? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll deal with the questions as they were asked. I hope I got the gist of all of them, and there's some overlap. The first question was the intention of this will to narrow the mandate of the director, and was asked whether the submission is not trying to broaden it. The intention is really for the directorate to use the information it has at its disposal that it collects through its investigations and make recommendations based on that to the Secretariat and to the Ministry. I think it's important for an institution that does these type of investigations that they look at what the trends are, but also what the systemic failures are, because it falls broadly within the obligation to prevent torture and ill treatment. Why would we keep on doing the same thing and not fix the cause? So it is in that sense that I think it's important that the directorate looks at what the trends are, what the systemic causes are, because they understand the system. The second question dealt with the delegation of powers. The issue raised in the submission around the delegation of powers pertains specifically to cases to be referred to the NPA, and that authority is not delegated. My suggestion is that one either needs to provide some level of oversight at the executive director level about what gets referred to the NPA, or alternatively that one devolves that authority and includes it in the powers that can be delegated to provincial level. But as the submission points out, to have that authority centralized at the very top of the directorate is going to create problems in terms of the processing of cases. The third question dealt with independent persons to have access to information. The issue here that we raised in the submissions is public scrutiny over investigations. And this is a requirement that comes from international law. And I think it's important we have transparency around that. And there are ways in which one can structure that in a manner that it does not compromise investigations or compromise sensitive information. But the principle from our perspective is that we must have public scrutiny over investigations so that there can be no questions asked about how these things are being done and who controls it. The fourth question deals with a statement I made that there are no independent bodies visiting police stations. Madam Chair, I will probably have to amend what I said there, but what I meant was that there are no independent bodies that visit on a consistent basis, on a continuous basis. There are bodies that visit occasionally, but there's no structure that is set up to visit all, probably 1,000 police stations on a continuous basis, and that is what is envisaged with a visiting mechanism. So it was said in that context. I think we can look at the judicial inspectorate as an example of a civilian visiting mechanism to prisons in South Africa. So when one compares that, one sees that a similar structure does not exist to monitor police detention. The question was asked whether one can compare the IPED and the JICS. Yes, there are different foci, but both have an investigative mandate, and in the case of the judicial inspectorate, they must also inspect places of detention. The comparison with the judicial inspectorate is useful from our perspective because it has demonstrated that one can set up a structure to proactively visit places of detention that is managed and run by the police and thus promote transparency. It is not envisaged that these individuals who would visit police stations conduct investigations. No, their task is, their purpose of their visits are more preventive in nature, to see what is happening. They are not investigators. They are members of the community, similar to the independent prison visitors that we have at the moment. And I think that will only add value to the mandate of the Secretariat if one has such a visiting mechanism. It also promotes community involvement in policing and the treatment of detainees. The sixth question dealt with, there was a question around redress and whether this is not too broad. The report, it's a reporting requirement on. I think it's important for the directorate to at least track the cases it has investigated and what has happened to those cases. So ultimately, in terms of our obligations under the Convention Against Torture, we must supply information not only to the Committee Against Torture, but for our own purposes to see whether justice has been served in the case of victims of torture. So it is in that sense. I don't think it falls within the directorate's mandate, and it shouldn't, to actually deal with victim redress and victim rehabilitation. Those are for other functions, but it must inform how they are going about their business. A question was also asked about the definition of torture and how we can possibly deal with that. I don't think there's a 100% clear answer on this, because one can look at a transitional arrangement to adopt a definition now and put it in place for 2 years, and when the other legislation comes into force, well, the risk is there, and I'm talking from a human rights perspective, that the other definition may be weaker than the definition that we include in this bill. So it's really a tricky situation. I think the ideal way, and it's probably, I hope, the correct way, is that we get the other legislation passed as soon as possible, even if it is only limited to passing a definition on torture. The rest of that legislation can follow later. But the definition of torture is central to the functioning of the directorate.
In the event we cannot do that.
Chairperson, I think then the safest is to adopt an interim definition as it is written in Article 1 of the Convention, and then we must take our chances with what the other legislation is going to do. But in the absence of a definition, I think the situation is worse than having an interim definition. I've dealt with support and redress, this paragraph 16. I've dealt with that. It's merely a case of reporting there. The question was asked about the cases that was referred to the NPA and whether this is purely administrative and dependent on the recommendation from the investigator. My reading of the bill is that it clearly says that the executive director may refer certain cases to the NPA. So my understanding is that discretion sits there. And then
very particularly that that authority to refer cases to the NPA has not been delegated. And so that discretion sits there. And I have a problem with that. I think it creates a number of risk situations. And then lastly, on independence and impartiality, the issue of impartiality and independence is raised in paragraph 1 of the submission merely as background to the importance of these two qualities for any investigative directorate. Paragraph 2 then deals specifically with the appointment of the executive director, and it says that the executive director will be appointed by the minister. But that the process by which the appointment is made is not set out in the bill. And our submission is that this is problematic because of the importance of the executive director in guiding the IPID and to ensure the independence and impartiality of the IPID. It's admitted that the appointment process needs to be set up in the legislation, and further that the final selection be made through a selection panel comprising of members of parliament, the proposed civil secretariat for the police service, and other selected stakeholders. Now, by way of example, the executive director of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services is selected by the inspecting judge, but the actual administrative process of appointment is done by the Commissioner of Correctional Services. The Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services had a problem with a judge making an appointment, and that's why they split it. And that was only amended in 2008. What we are saying here is that that appointment process needs to be opened up and broadened. Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks, yes. With regards to Committee Police 4, I may not be able to give you the status quo as it prevails now, but I'll give you my understanding of the status quo the last time I checked. But let me start by saying, consistent with the provisions of Section 206, subsection 3C of the Constitution, this bill again says it is the responsibility of provinces to promote good community police relations in Section 14, subsection 2B, 1 of the bill. So in terms of that, I think it's fine. But when going through the SHS Act, Chapter 7 of the Act, the establishment of community police forum at the station and at the provincial level, in terms of the board, is the responsibility of the station commissioner and the provincial commissioner. And amongst others, they are also expected to participate in the board and the forum respectively. The same, I think, was contained in the interim regulations, which were promulgated on the 15th of May 2001, which speaks to the same issue that provincial commissioners at the provincial level and all the other levels going down should take responsibility for establishing committees, police forum, and board. But the reality is that because that function is given to commissioners at all those levels, the practical experience has been that that function has been left to any other police officer who is not very busy at the time, particularly at the local level. At best, it has been given to officers charged with crime prevention issues. And many a time, there is no interaction between members of the community and the second commissioners or provincial commissioners in the form of the board or the forum itself at the station level. The role of the secretariat with regards to that has been very minimal to the best of my recollection. Safe to say that way back in 2002, if my recollection is correct, there was an attempt to address the situation in response
through the interim regulation issued from Margate Line. And the consultative process was established by the National Secretariat with full participation of community police forum structures and with full participation of provinces. To the best of my recollection, that process aborted. It did not result in any new changes in the functioning and activities of community police forum at all levels. Hence, I'm saying maybe it is necessary in the spirit of promoting good community police relations as provided for in the Act and the Bill to relocate the function from the police to the Secretariat so that there is oversight of commitment and full participation of the FAPS into activities of community police forum. With regards to the issue of term of office of the Secretary, Section 6.1 of the Bill says that the Secretary is appointed subject to laws governing the public service. The laws governing appointment of heads of departments and heads of components states that they are appointed on a limited contract, 5 years, which is renewable for 5 years at a time. But there is no limit as to how many times can it be renewed. And therefore, at the national level, I suppose that may be the line that we may equally need to follow with regards to the National Secretary as accounting officer and head of department of the Secretary. In provinces, however, you have two scenarios that are at play currently. You have instances where you have departments at the provincial level which are operating as two departments under one political head. In terms of the environment we are dealing with now, I may not have a typical example at hand, but the structure that is there is like, for instance, when you go into housing, you get the Department of Local Government and Housing. But in terms of accounting officers, you have an accounting officer for local government and an accounting officer for housing, under one MEC for local government and housing. But administratively, you have two distinct departments operating. In other instances, you have civilian oversight. As I said, we have a scenario where we have civilian oversight in provinces as a standalone department and as a unit or a component within a department, like in KZN, Eastern Cape, and I can't remember which other provinces. I'm not sure in terms of how the structure is organized there, but I'm imagining here that you are in KwaZulu-Natal where the secretariat is part of the bigger department and there is an accounting officer who is appointed on contract. Suppose the accounting officer is at the level, whatever level, DDG, whatever that you know how to call it. Then you have this one person, Emmanuel, who is the chief director amongst other chief directors. But he has been unfortunate in that he is appointed to head the civilian oversight function of the department. Now, this one chief director then gets appointed on contract, when the rest of the chief directors in the department, reporting to this accounting officer, are appointed permanently. It creates a little bit of a problem for me. But in provinces where the head of the secretariat is also head of department, you would then expect that they must be appointed just like any other head of department. But in instances where the secretariat is just a component within a bigger department, if that person is not the accounting officer, it may not necessarily be fair on this person that this one level, which is among a few levels in the same department, should then be subjected to contract appointment.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure the members will want to make follow-up questions. In an event you do not, I will probably allow the Secretariat and the ICT just to comment on some of the submissions that were made both after lunch and before lunch, if you have issues that you want to respond to before we close.
I said the first and then second summit.
Yeah, Chair, I said I want to delegate that to my staff. Section 6. Yeah, thank you. I just want to maybe start with a factual matter and then I'll just quickly, Chair, refer to other issues. The speaker, Mr. Minton, indicated that there's no other institution that visits cells and so on. Maybe just I can refer the committee to our annual report of last year that was tabled and discussed in this committee. And we've indicated in that report that there was 596 station visits by ICD, as well as 473 cell inspections. So I just want to bring that to the attention of the presenter, that that practice is also currently done. I think in terms of the question about the definition of torture that was raised by various speakers as well as the committee members, I think in the final analysis, if the torture bill can clarify that, that will be excellent, but I think we're working now with this legislation and we must make progress. And I think if a definition should be included, maybe the current international definition should suffice. Currently, ICD is also using that as our benchmark, and I mean that can be amended. There was also an indication that Section 25, the list of complainants, be extended in terms of torture. That's maybe a possibility. Maybe the rationale for keeping it to a closed group is to ensure that those complaints that come has got merit, that's been properly considered, to ensure that we're not being overflooded by domestic issues or, you know, issues that's not really within our priorities. But I mean, if there's other institutions that kind of one can look at that. Then I think also the focus in the IPED bill should be really on you know, action omissions by members of SAPS, and I think that is really the focus that we want to bring. There was also questions about the purpose of the IPED bill that is not clear. I think focus is really to be investigative driven, and I think we've indicated that also yesterday. Then the procedure for torture complaints, I think there is a referral in clause 25 and 31 that in the regulations we want to include that there as well, that there's legal certainty by complainants with regard to that, so that there is a process that can be followed and will be accessible to members of the public. Then, Chair, that is with regard to the submission of the Institute of Security Studies. I think the presenter indicated wrongly, said that the ICD didn't want to prosecute the former commissioner. I don't think it's correct. I think I was alerted to by my colleagues that at that stage there was no sufficient evidence for the ICD to make further inquiries at that stage. So there was no decision by the then ICD not to continue with that matter. In terms of the suggestions made with regard to procedure to be followed in terms of recommendations, I think it's valuable, but I mean that's for the Secretariat, I think, maybe to consider, but I think he made valuable suggestions in terms of timelines. Then we absolutely agree So the submission by Mr. Newham, we also indicated that ensuring that all police officers are compelled to report all deaths, rape or torture related to police action or in custody to the IPD immediately, and any failure to do so results in sanction. We agree with that, and I think we also put that on the table. And then, very importantly, I think an issue that hasn't been really raised during the last 2 days is the question of the necessary support to IPD, adequate investigations by the policing agencies. They referred to the Kakana case. In that case, for instance, the outstanding issues that really were made it difficult for us to finalize our recommendations to the National Director of Public Prosecutions was the fact that the pathological tests, as well as those with relation to the firearms, we were dependent, of course, on SAPS to do it quickly. So that process took months. So I think that's also an important issue when we go to the regulations as well, or the memorandum of understanding we referred yesterday in the implementation plan, that the roles of the various agencies should be spelled out, timelines, protocols, and so on. So we also think that's quite important. Then with regard to the matters of rape and torture, we're not going to really deal with that in terms of his submission. Then the matters that the IPED may investigate, I think we agree that systemic problems is really the domain of the Secretariat. But I think the referral in the Act is to systemic corruption, and that's maybe an issue that should be defined in the definitions to make clear what it's exactly is systemic corruption. But again, I think our view is also with regard to corruption issues, it's a may, and there are various other institutions that is very well very well placed to also play a very important role there in terms of the police, the Hawks, the ICU. So there's a lot of other institutions that play a role there, and I think the idea is that ICD's role will be complementary. That will not be a major focus, but complementary depending on trends that may come. And then also, I think, that was that submission. And then with regard to the submission by Mr. Minton, I think we've already referred to the issue of the cell visits and cell inspections. Then again, I think in terms of torture as well, ICD in terms of our role in terms of torture is to really look at cases reported to us in terms of the police environment. It's really not our aim to become the national mechanism. That is a different process. And I think we want to play a contributory role to ensure that this matter is addressed effectively. Yes, Chair, I'm not going to come on to the other things at this stage.
Thanks, Chair. I just want to make some general comments on, two of the presentations are quite similar in nature. The two on torture. I mean, I think we need to be quite careful because my impression is that justice bill process is at quite an advanced stage and it's actually now in the office of the ministry, and I think we need to liaise around that before we start putting things into the legislation. I mean, the debate on the definition of torture has been a two-year debate, and I don't think it's a simple issue of just coming up with an interim definition, because if we do that, it could be very dangerous, because what if the next definition, as you say, is more limited? Then it becomes an issue of whether that legislation will go through. It becomes that opening up of already what has taken a two-year debate on torture. So I think that what may be a better approach, certainly from our perspective, is instead of us to slot things into the legislation without having been part and process of that two-year debate, is to engage with the Justice Department about how we address these issues, and maybe to come back with some recommendations to you, and also to get some idea, because, as I say, from what I understand from yesterday and this morning's discussion with Justice, that it is at a very advanced stage. But I think we need to just engage and just maybe engage with them in the process rather than just slot in some definitions. I also think that I just want to caution in terms of capacity, in terms of extending. You know, we can extend legislation to do a whole lot of things, but then we need to make sure we're going to have the capacity and the resources to do it, because I don't think the Secretariat will want to fall into the mistakes of that the ICD has fallen into because of the dysfunctionality of the Secretariat, where too many things get put on the plate of the Secretariat and it's not able to implement those things, similar to what happened to the ICD, partly because the Secretariat was dysfunctional. Now because the ICD's scope is being narrowed, we must be careful, and I refer specifically to visiting each and every police station in terms of cell visits. I'm not saying that that isn't something we can consider, but it's just something we need to be quite cautious about. I also just want to raise the issue of, to reinforce what was said about systemic issues with relation to the ICD or systemic corruption issues. And I think that the Minister has used a very good example of saying instead of the ICD investigating an individual, each and every individual policeman who may be accused of corruption, there may be particular incidences where the Minister, the Executive Director, the provincial executive, MEC, or the secretary picks up, for example, like Jeffrey's Town Police Station, where there is a systemic corruption issue, where non South Africans are being targeted for corruption, and it becomes a almost systemic issue within that station, which the ICD would then be asked to look at. The other thing I just wanted to raise is when one refers to investigation in the Secretariat legislation. And it may be necessary to define what we mean by investigation. And I'm not suggesting we change the word investigation. But we're not talking here about your police investigations. I think we need to be clear. We're not talking about a criminal investigation. But just to give you an example, a concrete example for the Portfolio Committee. At the moment, the Secretariat is involved in a significant investigation into the Central Firearms Registry and how it's functioning. That isn't just an assessment or an evaluation. It's an intensive investigation into the whole functioning of a system. So I think we must be careful of removing the word investigation. Maybe we need to define it a bit better, but I would be concerned about putting in the word assessment, because what we're doing with the Central Firearms Registry is not just an assessment. It's much more in-depth than that. But it's also not a criminal investigation. Then I just wanted to comment on the ISS presentation. For me, the ISS presentation didn't remove stuff from the Secretariat, the presentations that they made, actually enhances what is already in the Secretariat legislation. There may be some areas of disagreement on some of the wording, and I think we must be careful when we talk about just the broad access to information that the Secretariat must provide, because we could land up spending half our life involved in court challenges around what access to information we're providing. But certainly for me, the ISS presentation, certainly a lot of the suggestions they made, I think would enhance our legislation and the ICD's legislation, and some aspects from the ICD may better fit into the Secretariat, but I think certainly for what they've come up with enhances our legislation. Then finally on the presentation from the colleague from Limpopo, I think that the issue around the CPF is something that we need to consider quite seriously, because I think the Minister's intention is that the CPS will move into the Secretariat. But there is a policy process at the moment that we're engaged with, our partnership unit and the policy unit, and it may be something we want to look at in terms of regulation and amendments to the SAPS Act, rather than to rush into just taking what is in the SAPS Act and putting it into the Secretariat Act, because I think that would be that we could land up just recreating some of the problems. And certainly, for example, who actually constitutes the CPS is a question that has to be asked within this policy, because the Secretariat doesn't have the capacity to go out to each and every police station necessarily and do the actual constitution, you know, do the constituting core meetings and establishments of CPS. So those are some of the things that are being discussed at the moment. And I think it would be better rather than, I think the point being made that it needs to move into the Secretariat is exactly what the Minister's intention is and why that's been included as one of the functions. But the details of it need to be spelled out through the regulation process in terms of the Act, rather than for us to just take out from the SAPS Act. I just want to also just, but I think it's an important point that's the principle that we're looking at going with. So I think that's it's quite encouraging to see that somebody from Limpopo who's got experience in CPS is actually supporting that position. Just the issue of the, I think we need to be clear that the that there's a distinction between the heads of departments and the heads of secretariats. That the heads of department do get appointed by the Premier, the heads of the secretariats don't. But also that the if you look at the SAPS Act, the provincial commissioners and the national commissioners, it's actually supposed to be two terms. And we want to align the secretary with that. I think the question there is, and I hear what was said about another chief director, and it's something we have to grapple with, but I think the principle was also that it's an important thing that within the national secretary as well as the provincial heads of the secretariats do not become bigger than the institution. And that happens when somebody is often appointed for life. They become the institution. I think we were trying to avoid that. Certainly the appointment of the secretary for the two terms, it's been checked with the Public Service Commission. There's no, in fact, that's the current appointment process, so it's not in violation of that. Thanks.
Madam Chair, this issue of torture, I think the secretary and the drafters must look at EC, because EC, the term is there in the Act. So there are two things. If it was not in the Act, probably one could run away and say, don't have a definition. But it's there in the Act. And for any thing you have, if somebody were to ask, what do you mean by a complaint of torture, referred to by the... We need a definition. Whether we're going to have to wait or borrow, whatever, but we need to find a way of dealing with this issue of torture. The second one, I thought the secretary would answer. The gentleman, Mr. Matiza, says there are critical functions of the secretary which are in the white paper, which are not included in this act. And I thought probably you would comment on that.
Sorry, I didn't want to comment on the actual presentation because I think I was under the impression I had to comment on the issues you had raised. But I think that just on the torture issue, one of the things that we could look at doing in the interim until the legislation from Justice comes through is to put in place guidelines around the torture, to require that guidelines be put in place and brought to the portfolio committee, as opposed to actually defining it in the Act, which could create problems with the Justice Department. I think that's something that could be looked into, is the questions of tabling guidelines, because if they're not written in, wouldn't create a problem for the justices' process. But I think that's something we could ask maybe the state law advisors to look into for us. The issue of the social crime prevention, I think our partnership unit and the question of one of the objectives to mobilise, etc., does cover that quite substantially. And I think one of the issues that we are in discussions with SAPS around in terms of the implementation is that SAPS at current have a massive social crime prevention component. And to what extent will many of those functions come across to the Secretariat? But it is covered in relation to the partnership unit within the Secretariat and under the objectives that cover the partnership unit.
Yeah, you can ask questions. I will allow members to ask questions, maybe because we are on time.
It's not necessarily a question, but I would like to just, if you allow, ask the state law advisors what would be the effect if we don't define, whether there would be a problem if we don't define torture at this point in time in the legislation. If they can just communicate to us, if you don't mind, Chair.
Okay, my comment is related to this issue. Developing guidelines internally for the directorate to use to investigate will solve the directorate's problem, but it doesn't solve the NPA's problem on what is it that they will use to prosecute people. So we're a bit stuck.
Thank you, Chair. The consequence of not defining torture as a term, specific term,
in the bill would mean that, would have the effect that the word will be given, or the term will be given its ordinary grammatical meaning, dictionary meaning as such. So that would be the effect thereof, should it be retained as it is. Should it be defined in view of legislation in the pipeline, it could have the effect that it could be too broad or too narrow, and that will cause further amendments to be brought into the bill should it become an act of parliament, and then there's all sort of other issues with regard to alignment. So it is a subject that should be dealt with like with judges at the moment. Maybe if we have more feedback as to what stage it is, I think the Secretary indicated that it is really an advanced stage already, so maybe if we could just get some sort of clarity on as to where exactly they are, and maybe we can take it from there. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, no, thank you very, very much. Thank you, members. This is a public hearing session, and you wanted to say something. Okay.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify one thing, because it's been said not just in this forum, but in a number of forums recently, and even with SAPS members, there's no such thing as a white paper expiring. We clarified that within government. The white paper doesn't expire, it gets amended. I'm not exactly sure why SAPS put a time date on the cover of their white paper, but according to our information from discussions with all the different government departments, the white paper doesn't expire, it gets amended, and I think we need to be clear on that, because I think it's come up a couple of times in different forums, and I think the police have often presented it as having expired.
There's no other hand now. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Matisse. I'm specifying you because you made a presentation as an individual. And if you were to prepare for another presentation in future, you'll be able to judge yourself on the basis of what you did today and say, I have improved. And it is in this way that you can actually improve. And I really appreciate what you have done. And thank you very much for that. And I want to thank all the institutions that have made presentations today. I think today's submissions have enhanced and broadened our understanding of the bill as members of Parliament. But also, I think today's deliberations have provided some solutions to some of the issues that we sharply raised yesterday. Of course, it will not be true if I also do not mention the fact that on other issues, I think they have complicated the torture, for instance. I think it was not much of an issue yesterday, but I think today it has become an issue, which I think all of us have to look into. But really, we thank you very, very much. Ultimately, we want to have a bill that addresses the issues and the problems that have always been identified by all of us, both in this institution called Parliament, but also other institutions as well. Members, our next meeting is on Friday. It will start at 9. It will be in this very house chamber. On Friday, we're going to have a presentation from African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum together with Community Law Center. That will be followed by University of South Africa, UNISA, Legal Resource Center, Center for Study of Violence and Reconciliation. We will keep to time. And I promise all of us who are here, if you come, you will not go off late. As a matter of fact, according to our program today, we're supposed to be adjourning at 5. I think it is 3:15. And unfortunately, oh, it's 3:00. I can't see, I told you. Really, I can't see. So we, because we're supposed to attend at 5, we'll therefore stay in the house here until 5:00 and we'll request others to lead us with shosholoza until 5:00. Thank you very much. There's tea outside and this meeting is adjourned.
That's